This is Kate Magruder. It's August 27th, recording an oral history for Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land Stories of Mendocino County. Would you introduce yourself?
I'm Gina Campbell.
Where and when were you born?
I was born in Long Beach, California, February 9th, 1948.
And could you talk about some of the formative experiences of your childhood? Just what kind of shaped you as you were growing up? What became really important to you?
Well, I grew up in Southern California. We lived in Newport Beach until I was seven, and then moved to Santa Barbara. And I really grew up on the water. My father was an avid boats person. We had a sailboat most of those years. And we spent a lot of time sailing or going to the beach. Even when I was in Santa Barbara, we went to the beach a lot. That really formed me. And the trips that we took as a family were predominantly on boats. And I think that was very formative for me. Well, particularly as a family, we spending time kind of isolated from the world. And I'm very close with my siblings. I have two brothers and a sister. We talk a lot, especially with my sister, I talk a lot. And spending months at a time, really. We spent 9 months traveling in Europe when I was 12, and coming back to the United States, we continued to drive across the United States for 2 months before we got home to Santa Barbara. I think I was always an avid reader, and having all that time on my own, I read voraciously. I had friends growing up, but thinking back on it, I was never one to invite friends over or anything like that. That came later in my life. I went to a private school, and I skipped a grade. And after we came back from Europe, I went back a grade and went back into my original class. And I think all of that also made me kind of isolated as well. Once I went back into my class, I felt much more comfortable and became friends with the people that I had started out with. We had not been friends for a while, but then I regrouped with them.
And so can you tell me kind of the short version, but the path that led you to Mendocino County? Why did you come here and when?
I came here in March of 1971. I went to college at Stanford. I graduated from high school in 1966 and went to Stanford. And there, I really blossomed as a person. I made lots of friends. I was not particularly social, but I felt like I'd really found my place. Our senior year, a fellow student in my class named Dave Foreman had a seminar on education that he led, and he was very interested in alternative education. So the seminar featured information about, and books, reading books about places like Summerhill and there were some teachers, can't remember their names, who had written books on education at that time. Out of that seminar, a group of people wanted to start a school. And Kathy Easterbrook, who had gone to high school in Ukiah and her family owned Rancho Mariposa in Redwood Valley, was involved to some extent. I was not in that particular seminar, but I was friends with several of the people who were. So I'm pretty sure that's how Mariposa school started. And so in the fall, I graduated in 1970, and most of the people who started the school also graduated then. There were a couple of people who actually went to the school to work who hadn't graduated yet. and then graduated after the first year. So after I graduated, I had married Billy Jameson, and we decided to move to Berkeley with our really good friends, Kate and Kit Anderton, who were a few years older than us, had also graduated from Stanford. And we went to Berkeley. I started getting a teaching credential at Berkeley. Billy was working in San Francisco as a carpenter. Kit was getting his teaching credential, and Kate was teaching kindergarten. I think that we just all felt kind of at a loss in Berkeley. I know that I did. I actually dropped out of my program and didn't know what to do. And Kit kept going on his program. A really good friend of ours, Pete Barker, was one of the people who had started the school, came to visit and said they were thinking of expanding the school and wanted more teachers, and encouraged us to consider coming to Ukiah to work at the school. We had already decided that we were leaving Berkeley, and we just hadn't decided where we were going to go. One idea was we'd go to Santa Cruz, where both Kate and Kit had family places to stay, or we could live. But we ended up visiting the school, and we were talked into moving up. Kate stayed in Berkeley and finished out the year of her contract as a kindergarten teacher. So that's how we got to Ukiah.
And so describe the first, where physically were you? Where was Mariposa School first off and when it was shaped here?
It was at Rancho Mariposa. The school started at Rancho Mariposa. Kathy Easterbrook Monroe, now, family owned the ranch, and her parents had been educators in the Bay Area, around Palo Alto someplace. And so they were interested in helping out with the school, with supplying a place for it initially. So it was an old ranch. There were old buildings, one main house, and several smaller cabins. And there wasn't enough room for everybody who was teaching there to live on the ranch. So there were four people when we moved there. There were four people who were living off the ranch. And there wasn't room for us. So the Frys, who lived next door, offered their land as a possibility to have some kind of small structure built. So we built some platforms with plastic tents on them. And Billy and I lived in one, and Kit lived in another. I think there was more than two, but anyway, we lived there for the rest of the spring, from March until June. We lived on the Fry's property up in the woods above the Fry homestead.
How did you heat that tent?
There was no heat. We had a Coleman lantern, and that was it. We had a bed. I mean, it was very small. It was just small, big enough for our double bed. And I think it was up on a plywood platform. We could put things underneath it, but that was it. No heat.
And did you all eat communally at Rancho Mariposa?
Yes, we all had meals together, especially dinner, which traditionally, and it kept on happening, that we would divide up the meals by week. So two or three people a week would cook, and there was a budget for each week that we had to meet. Plus we had got commodities, which was the precursor to food stamps in Mendocino County. So I think it was once a month there was I remember where it was on Main Street, the commodities place, and a few of us would go, and each person had a certain amount of commodities that they could get. So we just pooled them, you know, together, our supplies, and it was trying to figure out how to use what we got, you know, was always a challenge. Not always. I mean, some of it was really good stuff. Like, we got real butter, you know, but we had powdered milk and we had beans, a lot of beans and rice and stuff like that.
What was your coup de grace? What was your masterpiece on with commodities?
I really don't remember. I remember cooking beans, a lot of beans. And some of the stuff was really inedible. There was like canned meat that was just, you know, not edible. I think we fed it to the dogs. Oh, and I think there was pasta. So I think maybe, you know, we could make spaghetti or macaroni and stuff like that.
And then what happened?
Yes, after the first year, the school had to move. Kathy's parents decided they didn't want to have the school on their property. It was more than they had bargained for. So we moved the school into town to the Episcopal Church on Orchard Street and expanded the school as well. The reason that we had come was to expand the school. So we added a high school, and that was in the Junior Achievement Building on Perkins Street, which I don't think is there any longer. I think it was kind of on the corner of Leslie and Perkins. And Kit and Kate and maybe somebody else really ran the high school, plus the elementary middle school was expanded. I should go back. Mariposa started as a K-8 school, and there were 30 students in the original school, and I think we went up to maybe 70 students for the second year, and that was stressful. I think it really, you know, was in the long term, it was kind of stressful. Oh, and so other teachers had come. Buzz Hamburg he joined us in the fall of 71. Michael Laybourne also. Buzz was an elementary school teacher. That's how he met Carrie. Anyway, yeah. Being in town was really stressful. We were used to having the kids be able to just roam around the ranch when we were in Redwood Valley. So after just a few months at the church, we were able to find a place on Highway 20, and we moved the school out there for the rest of the year. So half the year in the Episcopal Church and then half the year in this place out on Highway 20. And meanwhile, we started looking for land, and there were a couple of people who were really invested in looking for property. And we looked, I remember going to a place on Orr Springs Road, but we ended up buying this place on Low Gap, which is where the school ended up for another, I don't know, 25 years or something.
How did you afford to buy land?
Well, our Stanford connections, basically. We tapped into some people who were interested in education. And I had a friend whose family had a foundation. They supplied some money for 3 years, I think. We also had a couple other friends. One of the people who started the school actually married and left during the first year. And her husband's family also had the resources to donate. And because Trish was, you know, had been an original member of the group, I think that was part of the deal with them. And then there were a couple other connections. And in 1972, when we actually bought the land, it wasn't very expensive. I think it was like $25,000 or something. And of course, we made a down payment and had a mortgage payment, you know, on it. The school, I want to back up too and tell you a little bit about the finances, because we made almost no money. We were paid $25 a month, room and board. And then there were some services that were provided by people who had kids in the school. Like the first year of the school, the Mowers and the Warings each had a son, and they were pediatricians, and so they gave us medical care. Later on, Bob Shugart, who's a vet, had his kids went to the school, but even before, he gave us free veterinary care. So we had a lot of support from the community. It's amazing to me how much support people just opened up to us. And so the school was also a sliding scale in terms of the tuition. So we had some kids who virtually, I don't think, paid anything to come to the school. And then the children of the more professional classes, like the Mowers and the Warings, Burl Post's son, David Post, was there. They paid either full tuition or very close to full tuition for their kids.
How did you recruit students? How did the community know you were there?
It's amazing to me to think back on it. The story that I always heard about the original was that at the fair in August, at the fairgrounds, they had a booth. And that was a really productive event for the school. They had lots of people come up, very interested. But it's amazing to me that these kids, basically, 21, 22-year-olds, were given the responsibility of educating 30 children without any experience, or with very little. I mean, very little experience. I think some of the people had, had been teachers or counselors or things like that. But I think people really wanted something new for their kids.
And once you moved out to that land on Low Gap Road, how did you begin? How did you live? It was just a piece of land.
Well, we kind of divided up the needs. In order to live there and develop the land, we divided up different projects, like developing water, finding out about septic systems and buildings. And fortunately, we had Michael Laybourn had worked as a draftsperson before he moved up and had skills designing and drafting plans. Billy had carpentry skills. Other people just learned on the job about water supplies. Somebody researched wells and water tanks and that kind of thing. So we started off, basically people camped out. We were able to afford a house in Redwood Valley where Billy and I lived with several people. We had lived there the year before, after we left Mariposa, Rancho Mariposa. We lived in the house on East Road, and then other people lived in a house, rented a house on Perkins Street, which is no longer there. It's about where the savings bank is now. So we had these two houses. Then we stopped renting the house on Perkins Street, and a bunch of people moved out to the land and started building these little one-room cabins, which are still there and still being used. And the first thing we did was Billy and Michael designed this one-room building that was started in that first summer and was able to be used in the fall, and then just had scraped together plastic tents and other places while we built the second building the next year.
And was there also a communal kitchen?
Right, yeah, there was a communal kitchen. In fact, there was this place called the Plastic Palace, which was the kitchen in the evening and was a classroom in the daytime. And then after the building, which became the K2 building, there was a little kitchen attached to the back of that. But there was no bathrooms at that time. That came later.
Were you in county or city?
We were in the county, and Billy likes to tell the story of the what he called the workshop, because it became, for a little while, it became the shop before it became the K2 building, that he made a model of it, and he and Michael took it to the building department, and that's how they got the permit for it, because it was he did all the details, and it's actually a beautiful little building. It's a kind of a timber frame building with connectors, and it's a handmade building. The next building was a pole building, and Michael, as I said, had worked for architects in Berkeley, and one of them was Sim Vanderen, who later became the state architect, and he was interested in pole buildings. So Michael worked with him on designing a building, a pole building for that, for the second building, and Sim Vanderen signed the plans that were submitted to the building department. And I worked on that building. I stopped teaching and worked on building that building.
How did the community, the government agencies, how did they receive you? How did they receive you as individuals around town and as a school?
Gosh. Well, the community in general was pretty supportive. And I look back on, especially the community right around us on LOGAP, there were people who had lived their whole lives out on LOGAP and were ranchers, sheep ranchers mostly, and I think we must have been a pretty big shock to them. But later on, we had some legal problems, and they were very supportive of us. As far as the building department went, the houses that were built, the little houses, were red tagged at one point and became part of that whole incident of, well, it was the pre-Class K, and actually those houses were never put into Class K. There was another solution to that problem, but so we were in trouble with you know, for that. But the school buildings were permitted. All the school buildings were permitted.
When you think back on that time, what was a highlight? What was one of the times that you just thought, this is just so wonderful?
I actually struggled a lot. I've been wondering whether how much to talk about my own personal feelings. I moved to the school and immediately got pregnant. I later figured out that I was not a teacher, and it was a teaching community. So I didn't fit in. I think the thing that was the most important thing to me was given the opportunity to work as a carpenter and learn those skills. It was a difficult time, and it was, you know, I was 24 years old, and I was 23 when Rose was born, when my daughter was born that year. And balancing being a new mother, and I was still teaching, and not sure what I was doing. What in the world? What was I doing here? So that went on for a while for me. I was kind of displaced for quite a while. But the best thing was, the community was good. I mean, the people, we had a good time. You know, we had a regular brunch on Sundays and then would play volleyball. There's a floodplain below the school buildings right by the creek. And it was a really good group of people when we were on LOGAP. Some of my best memories are hanging out with the people that were there.
What did you go on to do? How did you go on to the next step?
Well, Billy and I, we were there until 1976, but in 1975, we decided to look for a place of our own. And fortunately for us, Dave Nelson and Phyllis Webb had bought a place further out on Pine Ridge Road, 2 miles further out from the school. And they had bought it with a partner who had decided to back out. So they were looking for somebody to buy in with them. We were looking for land. So we became partners, and we're still partners with them in our property. So we then designed a house and started building it in the summer of 1976. Built and moved to the land in 76, and we're still there. So as I said, you know, my experience working as a carpenter, and then Billy got his contractor's license in 1974 and started working on projects locally. We had a couple of carpenters working for him. It needed another one. So I started working for him as a carpenter in 77, I think, and worked for him for 2 years. And then decided that I needed to move on. So my skills had given me the courage to look for something in the architectural world. And fortunately, I was able to get a job with Ron Moe, who is a local architect, and learned how to formally learn how to draft from him. I had done some drafting, but it was not what I learned from, you know, I learned the real thing from Ron. And so I moved on from there into the career that I've had ever since, which is as a residential designer since 1980.
How did you become more involved in the community? What happened next with you as you began working in the community?
My work in the community emerged just through word of mouth. You know, by that time, I think Billy and I were both pretty entrenched, and I worked for Ron, but I also started getting work on the side as well. I knew other builders from Billy. He needed help with projects. I think it was through other builders, other people that I knew who through building where that started. And then, of course, in 1982, we were asked to design and build the Ukiah Playhouse. And I think back on that and think, I really hadn't been doing this very long. It was less than 2 years since I had started my drafting career. But I also, we knew a lot of people who gave us a lot of help. George Rao's office, who I later went to work for, but at that point I wasn't working in his office. He provided the engineering for us, and other people, you know, we just tapped into our building community and came up with a lot of, you know, a lot of help, a lot of donated labor and goods for the playhouse. And I don't know that I really, that other than it meant a lot to me personally, as far as professionally, I don't think I really got more work out of that particular job, except for, you know, in the long run, you know, I think people knew, I mean, like with you, you know, but it was okay. I mean, that wasn't what I was looking for. I never was looking for that. I always have had plenty of work. I've always, for whatever, I've always had as much work as I could handle.
What have been some of the highlights of living in this community over the years?
Well, besides the Playhouse, which I, you know, we've talked about before and was definitely the highlight of my career, even though it was, I look back and think of all the the things I could have done better. I think the highlights have been my clients. I've been really lucky to get to know a really wonderful group of people. Some of my clients have been not easy, but most of them have been, I've really enjoyed getting to know people. And of course, my kids grew up here and went to high school here. So even now, I'm doing a job right now for somebody that my daughter went to high school with. I did a job last year for a young woman who my son knew all the way from Mariposa all the way through high school. And that gives me a lot of pleasure to have that connection with my children's friends, you know, and to work with them on a professional level. That's been really good. And see them, you know, as adults and in their lives. That's really special.
As you look back on that and the fact that you came up, what were you thinking you were going to do with your life?
I had no idea. I had no idea what I was going to do with my life. I had dropped out of my program to become a teacher, and then I tried to be a teacher, and I couldn't do it. It wasn't for me. And so, as I said, I was kind of lost for a while. I had been an art major. I took art classes. I even commuted to Santa Rosa for a while, taking life drawing and watercolor classes at Santa Rosa Junior College. And I thought I would get back more into that. But then I became pregnant again and with my son, and I couldn't really do that trip anymore. So I don't really know. You know, I think that I lucked out by being able to see the combination of art, drafting, and building, and my father had been a builder and had encouraged me to become an architect, but I had no role models. As a woman, I didn't have any role models in that way, and I thought that I had to know how to build. And so once I did know how to build, it was sort of a no-brainer. This is what I need to do. But I didn't know what I was going to do. And I think graduating from college when I did in 1970, there were a lot of opportunities for women that were opening up, but we still didn't have the role models of what women have now or have had for the last 30 years or so. So I feel lucky that I could have a career that I kind of made up in Ukiah, and I've realized that I couldn't have done that if I was living in a bigger town or a city, because I found my way. I put it out that I was looking for a job as a draftsperson. I found somebody who was willing to train me, and then getting work just through friends of friends and through friends of builders and that I knew, and all that word of mouth. It's always just been word of mouth. I've never had to advertise or anything. I don't think it could have happened anywhere else except for maybe another, you know, small town like Ukiah.
What was it about this community? What was it that made it possible to happen here? Because I don't know if it could have happened somewhere else, you know, in another Occidental or someplace like that. You know, how is it, do you think, how have you been shaped by the fact that you chose here?
It's really hard for me to think about what about Ukiah shaped me. I feel like I just sort of bumbled along, you know. I don't know how to answer that question.
Well, let me do this. How do you think the fact that so many people like you came here to this county in the early 70s, how did that kind of collectively, what was the impact that had on the county over the last many decades?
The impact of the people who came here in the late 60s and in the early 70s, mid 70s, has really been tremendous. I can see that in so many different fields. The people, I think most of the people that I have worked with and been friends with over the years were in that group of that came in that time period. And if not directly in that group, I've met through other people who were in that group that came. I think that there's been a tremendous impact on this county. And I don't even know about the coast and Anderson Valley and Willits and Laytonville. But I do know, for instance, that KZYX in some way grew out of that also. And so it has united the county in its way by being the institution that collects us all together. It's one of the institutions. And there was the Mendocino Grapevine back in the 70s and 80s that also, as a print media, was doing that. I think that was an instrumental institution that united people, that gave people a voice to connect with one another. And so people on the coast and people inland could communicate with each other and know what was going on. And KZYX, I think, took that up as it has impacted the county over the last nearly 30 years.
What else? What else has happened here that has been shaped by that?
Well, I mean, to go back to the Playhouse, you know, I think the art community has all the different theater groups that have impacted the county.
Was there something about this place and the physicality of this place and just the character of the place, the consciousness of the place that allowed for a theater company to spring up, or that allowed for someone like you to make up what you were going to do?
I think that the makeup of the community, and I'm thinking of the larger community of the whole county, because of the nature of the people that came here in the 60s, late 60s, 70s, with talent and vision and energy to create a world is home for them, and continues to be home for them. So that places like the Ukiah Playhouse and KZYX and over on the coast, I know that that community has its places too. That's why I think that the impact of that movement, which I think was not really a movement. People came here because they wanted something. And not everybody got it, but a lot of people have stayed and made their lives, like whether it's in the arts or in professions or in government, building, you know, all kinds of ways that this larger community of Mendocino County has grown from that exodus from cities to what we thought was a country life. I didn't really think that so much. I just knew that I needed to get out of Berkeley and live someplace else, you know. And I go back to my childhood of growing up on the beach in Southern California, growing up on boats, and growing up in a community of my own that was not suburbia. It was, we had a lot of play and a lot of room for going out into nature, and you know, our parents didn't rein us in. We could do what we wanted to do, and I guess that's what we were doing in that time. We were doing what we were not expected to be doing. I mean, as far as the Mariposa people went, we'd gone to Stanford, and I think that our families were kind of astounded at what we chose to do. And a lot of the original people did go back and got law degrees and medical degrees and architectural degrees, and a few people became teachers and provided an opportunity for other people to come in and take over those roles, which they continued to do for many years.
What has happened to Mariposa School? Is it still going? Did it have a life cycle?
Yeah, what's happened to Mariposa is so interesting, because Mariposa School as a school lasted until 1999. And then it had changed a lot. The teachers no longer lived necessarily on the land the way they had. There were fewer teachers, but it was still not able, they weren't able to really pay the teachers properly. So the school closed down, but because it was a nonprofit organization, the land could not be sold unless it was sold to another nonprofit. So first it became a charter school for about 5 years, I think, Woodland Charter School. And that was not successful. Then it became a place was rented for different organizations. And for a little while, Tapestry Family Services had after-school programs there, and then that had to be cut. Their budget was cut, and that didn't work. Right now, I just found out yesterday that there's a group of people who are trying to make an intentional spiritual community there. And Joanne Rosen, who was a teacher back in the 70s and still lives on property behind the school, has, I think, encouraged this community. So it's moving into a new phase, which I think is very exciting. Something that I think we, you know, those people who started the school would really like to see, that the school still exists in some form of community. I just found this out yesterday. So it's very exciting. And I live 2 miles beyond the school. I pass it every time I drive to town, and most of the time I don't even pay attention. But sometimes I do, and it's just nice to know it still survives. And then the buildings were renovated a little bit by the charter school. They got some funds to do repairs and fix up the school. So it's been now, let's see, it's been 48 years since the school started, and it's been 46 years since the first school building was built on the land on Logap.
Do you have a particular memory about a particular time at the school at Mariposa with the when you just you could see the kids that it was just working? You know, it was just exactly what the school should be.
Well, the thing that that comes to my mind is Tony Rutledge's drama classes. The school was divided into peer groups. So there was like a K through 2 and a 3, 4 and a, you know, 5, 6 and a 7, 8 or something like that. Then there were elective classes that I think were usually around 3 weeks long that kids could sign up for. And then at the end of whatever that period of time was, 3 or 4 weeks, there would be presentation and parents could come and, you know, see the what kids had been doing. Tony Rutledge taught a drama class that was really special. And actually, I talked to Joanne Rosen yesterday about it because her daughter Jenny was in that class. And Tony would write plays and they would produce them. And they were so much fun. They were hysterical. So I remember that. And just the pleasure of the kids. And I've talked to kids who went there who are now in their 40s and 50s who remember it with great fondness. You know, that was one of the best times of their lives was when they went to Mariposa.
Is there anything else you want to say that you just know that needs to be included in this, you know, in this recollection? And
well, I do want to say that, you know, I wasn't at the school, I wasn't at the beginning of the school, so my memories are basically from, you know, halfway through the first year. And I think it would be interesting to have somebody who was there at the beginning and, you know, Kathy or Dave Riemenschneider, who are still local people. My memories of Mariposa are so just sort of random. It's like seeing little vignettes of events that happened. I mean, there's things that I haven't talked about. There we had a lawsuit, which we won, fortunately, that was brought by the man that we bought the land from. And that was a really difficult time. But I, you know, as difficult times are, we all came out very much stronger because we went through that together. And that was towards the end of the time when Billy and I were living at the school. That was in the spring of 1976 when was the trial of the lawsuit. Otherwise, you know, I think that Mariposa School, 29 years, that's a lot of students who went through that school. And I think the impact on the lives of those students, you know, resonated into the community. It rippled out into the community. And there are people, you know, like David Post, who became a wonderful vocal teacher, who was one of the original students at the school. And there was Steve Grant, who became a teacher, and Sid Maurer Jr., who is a teacher. And those are just the students who were there the first year, and others who I don't know what they've done, but Sarah Walsh is a teacher at the college, went to Mariposa in my son's class. It's not, and just not just teachers, but the freedom that kids were provided, because we haven't really talked about what the philosophy was, but it was to give kids the foundation, the basics, but also give them a certain amount of latitude to make choices. And that's what the classes were that were provided for them in the afternoons. The electives. Kids in elementary school, I don't think you really get those, but and I'm not really quite clear what the philosophy was, actually, but I just know that kids who went there, most of them really loved it. And when they talk about it, you can see that they were given something that they still treasure, deeply treasure, yeah.